This interview that you're about to listen to with Spencer Krause is fantastic. We talk about his business, SKA Custom Robots and Machines, where he and his team solve bleeding edge technology problems for their clients. We also talk about the future of autonomous robots and whether it's going to be dystopian or utopian. I found this conversation to be exactly what someone like me, who's not particularly technical, dreams of when speaking with someone who has a engineering mind. You'll hear how Spencer thinks through a problem, all the components that he's considering when he's assembling a solution to some of these technical challenges. And we also get into the craziness of trying to make a robot work when it's deep underwater. That and a whole bunch more. Here's my conversation with Spencer Krause.
Mildly intimidated because I am as minimally technically fluent as they come, but you live in this domain of solving really hard and complex problems in engineering, problems in robotics for your clients. And you've built an entire business around your ability to do that. So can you introduce your company SKA and what the services that you're consistently bringing to the market?
Yeah, sure. So thanks, first of all, for having me. I really appreciate being here. Big fan of your work as well.
And, thank you.
You should be intimidated. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, so what SKA Custom Robots and Machines does is we solve really, really difficult engineering problems for usually other technically sophisticated clients. So a lot of times we work for other robotics companies that are just trying to do something that they don't normally do, or maybe it's a product company where they've got, you know, a really good handle on, you know, the type of product they make, but they're trying to make a smart product. So, you know, they know how to make, we'll say, like, you know, presses all day long, but now they want to build a press that's got, you know, a circuit board in it and an LCD on it and, you know, has the ability to set all this stuff for you and is a little more automated. So we'll help them kind of go down that road or troubleshoot and zero in when things don't go exactly as well. From my background, I've been building robots for over 20 years. I started when I was a kid, and I just kind of always knew I wanted to do it the more I got exposed to robotics. What I always liked about robotics is that you can sort of, you get to wear a lot of hats, right? So there's no such thing as robotics in a vacuum unless you're in a university. I mean, we, in the last year, have worked on inspection robots. We've worked on construction robots. We've worked on, you know, handheld navigational devices for the military. And, you know, all that stuff, it gets you with different audiences and working in different domains. But the core technology that enables all those different things is more similar than different. And so what we do is we bring in people that have ideally worked across a lot of different disciplines and seen the parallels within those. And they can bring ideas from over here that maybe this industry has never seen before and, you know, do so in a professional and efficient way, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And so what's always interesting to me is, you know, even the most rudimentary tasks that are being done in some of these firms are over my head in terms of what is actually going on there and what those engineers have to do on a day-to-day basis. But what I can appreciate is that every business owner, if it is of one of these robotics firms or a government agency, whoever that leader is trying to make this, you know, calculation between optimizing for speed, optimizing for price, and optimizing for the meta game of the team that they're building in their own organization. So we both are mutual friends of the folks at RE Squared. I know they're a past client of yours, and they had their own facility with a big team of engineers.
Oh, they've got a bunch of facilities.
Right, that you know, was taking on all these hard problems. But even in that case, even when you have, you know, experts in these fields of robotics, the ability to, you know, quickly tap in an additional supplementary team to solve a hard problem, to allow you to move faster, is really where the kind of value add comes from SKA. Is that appropriate summarization?
I would say so. I mean, that's one. And then the other one is if we just have a team that isn't as technologically advanced trying to do a one-off technologically advanced thing.
Got it.
So those are really our two main markets.
Got it. And so how would you categorize the technologically advanced thing? Like that's very broad, but
yeah.
Basically, you know, when someone's coming to us, it's very discreet in terms of what they want to accomplish. They either don't have a video and they need a video, where they don't have the content plan and they need the content plan, it's somewhat discrete in terms of what that delivery will be. But if it's a problem that they haven't solved yet, it's really hard to define, like, how long will this take to solve? Yeah. How do we value the problem being solved?
I completely agree. And that's actually a really, really good good question. And I have a bunch of different things I sort of want to talk about here. So when we first started, we were sort of under the impression that we wanted to do, we made a lot of mistakes. And one of them was that we were under the impression that we wanted to be doing fixed flat rate work. You know, just, you know, this is what it costs. You know, this is how long it'll take. This is what you'll receive on this date. And that works well for companies that do things the same way over and over and over again. You know, if you're, not to pick on the automation guys, but if you're like an industrial automation machine builder and you're doing, you know, conveyor belts all day long and nothing but conveyor belts, you know pretty much, you know, to the week, like how long it's going to take, and maybe to the $1,000, how long it's going to take to install a new conveyor belt. Because the problems that we're solving are a little bit more novel than that, you know, we might be asked to do like a software system on a medical robot, for instance, is another thing we worked on. And, you know, a very short amount of time with very limited computational resources, not to bore people too much. But, you know, on that one, we don't know exactly how long it's going to take. I mean, we have a rough idea, but, you know, the scope oftentimes is a moving target on these projects. So, you know, a client will come to us and say, you know, we want to do X. And we'll say, okay, great. And initially we sort of believe them and we're like, okay, yeah, X is exactly what you want to do. You know, we'll spend, you know, 5-10 hours writing up a work scope and, you know, we'll follow that exactly and nothing's ever going to change. And of course, you know, and then what we found is, you know, we deliver something and, well, can you make it a little bit more like this? Or, you know, what about adding this extra feature? And, you know, you sort of like agree to do a few of those and then that becomes scope creep. And all of a sudden, you know, you're not making any money on that project. And the client's dissatisfied because you're over here and, you know, what they want's over there. And so finally, you know, we sort of figured out by repeated trial and error that, you know, the best way to do bleeding edge robotics, at least for us, and you see this with some other contract engineering companies in our space as well, is time and materials every single time.
Has that made it harder to sell? Because the reason a lot of companies will start with that, like, it's this fee, it's completely contained, it's completely, you know, defined from the jump, is that's a much safer, lower risk thing for someone to buy. It's like, I know what the investment is and I think I know what I'm getting. Like, it's a very simple calculus. But in this instance, it's like, it requires more trust. It requires more context. How's that been?
Yeah, so that was a great question. So because of the trust piece, and you're absolutely right. I mean, these are not small checks people are cutting or companies are cutting, I should say. You build that up over time. So, I mean, part of that is just doing a really good job over and over and over again. And we get, you know, the vast majority of our business just through direct referrals from past clients. Every single customer that we've had that hasn't gone out of business has come back to us for more work.
Nice.
And yeah. You know, and it's because we sort of err on the side of over-communication. And, you know, we don't screw people over. And, you know, we do really, really good work. But I guess going back a step, so how do you overcome that with a new account where you haven't actually worked with them yet, right? That's another one. So what we found tends to help us, and we even do this with repeat customers, is nobody wants to write a blank check, including me. And so, you know, I mean, that's totally understandable. It's reasonable. It's smart business. So the way that you get around that, at least the apprehension, is you say, look, well, I don't know if we'll be able to solve this problem because what you're asking for us to do has never been done before by any human on the earth, but we can get, you know, what's your approximate budget here? You know, okay, maybe we can allot, you know, say 80 hours to the problem. And when we get to 80% of those 80 hours, you know, one of our account managers will give you a call and tell you, hey, we're at 80%. This is what it looks like we'll be able to cover in the remaining 20%. Do you want to, you know, add some additional time to our cap on this project? Or would you prefer to, you know, desist and then, you know, maybe we'll call this one, you know, that's the research and development outcome we wanted. And then, you know, we can apply more effort later in the future on a different problem set, depending on what we discovered.
And that's received well. That's something that's working for a number of clients.
It is. Yeah. We actually are at a point where we need to sort of develop better procedures for tracking against those caps, because that's a business offering that people really seem to like, and our customers, you know, kind of keep coming back to, especially the technically sophisticated ones that understand that these problems are really difficult and there's no way to say you know how to do it if it's never been done before ever.
Yeah. It's such an interesting sale, because like even as you're doing these technologically advanced things, to some degree, there's, like once again, bring it back to our business. You know, most of our clients are super happy to give us a case study. Like you said, they're not going out of business or some sort of fire went off. They're like, yes, it was awesome to work with them. Here's exactly what they did. Here's the result. Very tangible. But if you're working for a government agency or if you're working for some deep technology company that wants to keep their stuff proprietary, it's really hard to be like, well, here's exactly what we did for this client and like all the problems we solved, because that's kind of, by definition, their secret sauce.
Yeah. And I mean, we run into that too, right? So, I mean, I'd mentioned, navigational devices for the military. I'd mentioned construction robots and I'd mentioned inspection robots. And I think I talked about a medical robot so far on this podcast, but you notice I didn't really go into detail about, who that was for or what exactly we did for them.
Right.
And that's kind of, we find ourselves in that position a lot of not being able to really brag about our best work because it's all top secret.
Exactly. It's such an interesting problem. Like you're selling something that is so, I mean, you're selling the solution to this theoretical problem that's brought to you, but it's so undefined in terms of like what the outcome or the capability is. It's just an interesting problem from like a marketing standpoint to try to optimize for.
It definitely, you definitely want to know, what the desired outcomes are, right? But rather than, you can spend a lot of time scoping in an outcome and, getting the legalese perfect, and you can spend more time than you would in execution of the project on scoping. I mean, I'm sure you've run into this too. And at a certain point, we've kind of just opted to run the opposite direction and say, hey, look, if at any point you're dissatisfied with our work, please fire us, there won't be any hard feelings. Like, let's check in weekly, twice a week, once every other week, depending on what, the schedule for this project wants, because they're all different. And, at those meetings, we'll catch you up on where we're at. Each of those meetings has an associated overhead with it for prep. And so, keep that in mind when you're picking your scheduling frequency. The less often, the greater the probability of drift, but also the lower the overhead on meetings. The more often, the higher the overhead on meetings, but, we're going to stay, pretty much, sleeping in the same bunk, as it were. Like, we know each other very well. And then, that kind of solves the same problem because, your clients are in really close, our clients, I should say, are in really close communication with us. And so, they would know if we weren't towing the line at any point. And, they're encouraged to cut at that point.
So when you bring up the meetings, what that makes me think of is one of my all-time favorite business essays by Paul Graham, The Makers versus the Manager's Schedule. And the premise of the essay is, managers need to fill their days with meetings because their job is to keep everything online, keep people unstuck, check in.
Guilty.
But the makers, the coders, the engineers, the builders, the writers, the video editors, they need these long uninterrupted periods to really get into a flow state, really get into deep work and produce something really excellent. So as you're assembling the talent that's capable of going and solving these, really bleeding edge problems, what have you learned about wrangling those people and creating the environment for them to actually be able to solve these really hard problems for your clients?
Sure. No, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked. So there's a lot of different things that go into it, right? I mean, as a huge part of being a manager is being a psychologist and understanding what makes people tick and giving them the tools they need to thrive and then getting the hell out of their way so they can do good work. And so I would say with engineers, I guess, are one brand of that. Designers are maybe another brand of that. And then I haven't done as much work personally with scientists because we're more on the development side than the research side of things. Our niche is actually referred to as early stage new product development.
Okay.
But so my work is primarily with engineers and technicians and a little bit with industrial and digital designers. But I guess to go back to your question, how do you get these people working in concert? I would say a big part of it is, don't just come up and tap them on the shoulder when they're working on something, don't interrupt their flow state. But, there's a balance to that because you don't want people to drift too far if their flow state, puts them in a place where now they're no longer aligned with the mission. And so I think that the way around it, in my experience, it depends on the person. Everybody's different is a really important thing to keep in mind. But for a lot of the professionals we work with, you're just setting, like a next touch point and having a clear agenda for that meeting and then, be it, you know, one-on-one with them, with a whole team, with a client and an account-facing group, or, you know, any kind of, you know, permutation thereof, you know, just making sure that on any given assignment or problem, you've got a check-in coming up at a point where if things are going horribly wrong, you have enough time before you need the thing to where you can figure something else out in that remaining time frame, if that makes sense.
It does. And to, you know, either buffer them or just better manage client relationships, how technically sophisticated does like an account management person need to be in the context of your business? Because like you're thinking about like it's always spoken more in the sales side, like a sales engineer who can sell the technology in whatever form it is and speak in a language of fluency that is resonant with a CTO, a CIO type of buyer. And then I'd imagine that that, you know, continues all the way down to the account side when we're talking about these really sophisticated problems. Like I would probably fail at being an account manager for you guys.
Well, you're actually getting at a really, really interesting pain point for us, right? Which is we do need technologically sophisticated salespeople. And that's actually, if you're interested, please contact, you know, Spencer at ska.solutions.
Yeah. And, we'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah. So, but we need people with technical backgrounds to do the sales. I'm a sales engineer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, there were a few other people that we've done good work with in that capacity, but it's really difficult to recruit for. A lot of times the best people, I think, in those roles are people with strong technical backgrounds who are just also personable.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you bring them through like, okay, now read How to Win Friends and Influence People. Good. You know, check out Jeffrey Gittimer's, you know, Little Red Book of Selling, you know, like, you know, and you give them some mentorship. Like, you know, if a customer asks you, you know, the answer to a question you don't know the answer to, you know, you tell them, I don't know, but I can find out. I mean, there's a few basic, you know, high points I go through whenever I'm training a new, you know, account person. And yeah, in our case, I mean, every successful account person we've had has been sort of a lead engineer type. So just an extroverted, personable engineer, but with a strong technical background. And those people close sales. I mean, if you bring on someone like that, that's got, you know, the domain expertise to solve a problem that your client is trying to solve, and they can demonstrate competence in that call, like a lot of times they'll, you know, sign with the company.
Absolutely.
Because they, you know, they know you can help them.
Or even as you articulated, all the businesses that you've worked with that haven't gone out of business continue to work with you guys, probably, you know, because of the technical competency of your team, but also probably because of the quality of that account relationship and their ability to be communicative, to clearly address the issues and the timelines and the roadblocks and all the things that come up. It's like, well, I like working with someone who's such a good communicator. That's what people want in a workplace.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of kind of the, it's a little cliched, but I mean, communication's pretty much at the heart of everything, you know?
Good
communication, good relationship.
100%. And any issues in the relationship usually stem from communication in some way, shape, or form.
Couldn't agree more.
So, you know, from that vantage point, I guess maybe not everyone, but the very online people, we're in the chat, imminent chat GPT-4. I'm probably even saying that wrong, but like that's coming. We've got, you know, Boston Dynamics robots that are increasingly doing scary things, giving me nightmares. I always like, we did this with Jürgen. We've done this with, you know, Henry Thorne, a couple other characters. From your vantage point as someone who's actually working on this, what is really drawing you in, you're paying a ton of attention to, you think is really not just technically significant, but like culturally significant?
That's interesting.
On the way that we live.
So that's a good question. I don't want to paint myself as an expert on that at all, because I'm not. I'm just a guy who helps people build robots.
But, right.
What I will say is, at least from my perspective, I mean, okay, so a few things to unpack here. One is, you know, robotics and AI are not the same thing. I am not an AI expert by any stretch of the imagination. I'm probably about the same level of understanding on something like ChatGPT as you. Like, it's just not my area. I mean, our teams have, you know, employed people that know about AI to do certain aspects of projects that require that knowledge, but it's not my personal strength. I just, you know, my background is in robotic systems development. That's what my master's degree is in. You know, I've been working on electrical and mechanical and software things since I was a kid, and not an AI expert. I can't say that enough. But I guess with that, you know, disclaimer aside, I've been really, really impressed with ChatGPT. I mean, it's the first real, like, you know, and I'm sure you've seen this too, like the first, you know, AI-based thing that didn't feel like snake oil to me you know, just as a member of the public, I was like, oh, this is real. You know, this is.
Yeah.
This is, and you know, the proof of the pudding's in the tasting. So interacting with it, I mean, obviously is what, you know, formed that opinion in my brain. I'm like, this is incredible, right? It's like, you know, clearly it passes the Turing test.
It is real utility.
Yeah. And it's like a hyper diligent intern, right? I mean, at this point.
Yeah. 100%.
It's only going to get better. So that's pretty cool. In the robotics space, it's hard to know, right? Because I mean, there've been so many advances in self-driving lately. But that's, by the way, a sector that also, like, SKA doesn't really do anything in self-driving. It's a saturated market sector. We also pretty much stay out of warehouse logistics, you know, just because.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, there's so many players in those areas. And industrial automation, too, is not really our niche. But, you know, basically, you know, it's easy to point the finger now with, you know, companies like Argo and Locomation, you know, falling on hard times recently. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I mean, there have been so many advances that those companies and even Uber ATG, you know, has moved the ball forward. And, you know, I mean, the assistive driving technology that we're seeing come out now is more advanced than it's ever been. So I do think we'll get back there. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of a matter of, you know, how and when, you know, I think. But that's another one, if I'm just commenting as a relative layperson, like that's.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I've been observing there.
What about the Boston Dynamics demos, though? Because in the spectrum of things that I'm once again, engaging with as a consumer, a layperson, there's things about ChatGPT that are simultaneously dystopian and utopian. Utopian, it's like, imagine how productive we can be. Imagine how much we're going to be able to produce. Dystopian, yeah. Someone's going to use this to do something horrible that's like beyond the pale of my imagination.
Yeah.
The autonomous vehicles.
I mean, people can do pretty horrible stuff on their own without robots.
without question. Yeah. But that most technology, it's a tool, right, to be used in one way or the other. Autonomous vehicles, yes, I can kind of wrap my head around like some negative aspects, but that seems wildly positive. We can actually get that deployed at scale, saving lives. Drunk driving's already on the decline, but like stuff like that, just.
Well, it does raise other interesting questions, though, right? Which is, like, at its core, the robo-taxi thing is almost like a public transportation problem you're trying to solve. So your real competition, you know, isn't necessarily automakers so much as it is city buses.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I've been sort of thinking about this a little bit, and again, not my area, but just a fun little brain puzzle, you know, sort of to.
You know,
Boston Dynamics. Sorry,
we've heard the stories of you know, on the public transportation point, heard the stories of like the person that had to take two or three bus trips to like get to their job or something. It's like in an autonomous vehicle future, theoretically at least, that there has to be some efficiency gleaned on that person's life
experience. Well, and I'll even say, you know, going away from autonomy, just I mean, like the rise of Uber and Lyft. I mean, it's great, right? I mean, my car can be in the shop, and I can still. You know, make meetings on the other side of town and you know, not be too much out of pocket for it, which is awesome.
100%. So you know, ChatGPT, slightly more utopian than dystopian to me. I can kind of see the dystopian side. Autonomous vehicles seems really utopian, especially like you're saying in industrial automation or, you know, like a robot going into a mine instead of a person just seems like a net good across the board. Maybe someone will argue with me on that. On the Boston Dynamics thing.
I've actually worked on mining robots a decent amount.
I believe it. So for the Boston Dynamics one, though, that seems more closer to the domain as you've articulated. Really interesting, complex robotics problems.
Okay. So let's be direct here. Like, what are your concerns? People strapping guns to, like, spots and just sending them into a battlefield? Or, like, what are you thinking of, like, explicitly?
To be really explicit, it just seems like, and maybe it's because it's the most... anamorphic is not the right word. What word am I looking for?
Anthropomorphic.
Anthropomorphic. There you go. It's the most anthropomorphic expression. And when it's doing these crazy things.
Because
it's
a quadruped?
I guess because it's a quadruped. It just feels like that's something a really bad person could use to do really bad things unimpeachably.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, practically though, you know, it's, you could do really bad. Okay. So when you say really bad things, I'm assuming you mean murder.
Murder, like the what's the movie with the guy with the mask? Remember the 5th of November?
Guy Fawkes, V for Vendetta. I actually don't think I've seen it, but
there you go. Well, that's good. Considering you haven't seen it. Yeah, V for Vendetta.
Quote
like,
a lot.
You know, they've got this kind of dystopian, like, security state, basically. That's basically the mega scary expression, well, so which I'm... is you have this security state, ability to deploy these robots in some sort of really terrifying.
So I'm thinking like Terminator,
experience.
You know, that episode of Black Mirror, Metalhead with like the little robot dog that kills people. And just goes around hunting humans, maybe the Matrix, right?
Yeah.
If we're trying to get sci-fi examples of just
exactly. I think those are
crazy
all
crazy dystopian robot futures.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, again, like, so maybe being a roboticist makes me less scared of this stuff because I realize how difficult it is to design, manufacture, and maintain robots. I mean, it's incredibly expensive. Like, if I was a malicious player and I wanted to subjugate a city, for instance, I I mean, it would be way more economical to do it with just a guerrilla army than to do it with robots. Like, it would be the most complicated way to go about that. And, like, you only need the robots, but now you need the maintenance infrastructure to make them do that. You need probably human operators with the current technology to get them to do that, which means you could just have those people with guns go in there and cut out the middleman.
Yeah.
It's not an efficient way to, you know, be a James Bond villain. Like, there's better ways to...
Noted.
To be horrible.
Noted for everyone out there. Maybe that'll be the challenge for later. No, I'm just kidding. So for... You've opened up a really interesting vector, though, wildly unappreciated by probably not only me, many of the listeners out there, the maintenance of these things.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, it's built. It did the cool thing. But it's like, you know, we take for granted that people have been iterating on automobiles for a century, and the reason it can go for hundreds and hundreds of miles and just pump a little gas and continue on its way is because of all of the, you know, decades of work and engineering that have gone into it.
Sure.
So help me get a little bit more legibility on some of the maintenance challenges that we probably don't appreciate.
Well, how many oil changes have you had in your life?
Yeah, a dozen.
How many flat tires have you had to deal with? You know, I mean, I don't know. There's even with that technology, there's tons of stuff that goes wrong. And as you put it, I mean, it's a really mature technology. I mean, we've got, you know, I don't know the numbers on automotive, but I mean, you know, I've been studying the Toyota production system a little bit lately, and it's really impressive just the level of thinking and care that's gone into quality for automotive, and automotive manufacturing automation is incredibly impressive. I've been in a few of those facilities, and it's, you can't unsee it. And so, I mean, I guess that's one thing, but robots are complex. I mean, cars are complex too. You've got HVAC, you've got, you know, a coolant system, you've got a fuel system, you've got hydrodynamic, to some extent, lubrication with the way your oil stays in your engine. You've got an electrical system. With autonomous vehicles, now you've got all these sensors you got to keep clean, and a compute system, which your car already has a compute system. That's the engine control unit, but now it's a much more advanced compute system, like something with like a GPU, like an NVIDIA AGX or something. But I guess I'm kind of rambling a little bit, and I apologize.
Don't apologize. This is what we're after, because just thinking through the problem, making it legible, is like a major step forward for a lot of people. It's not legible to me what the nuances and differences are in a robotic system and an automobile system. And this is great. Please don't stop.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's a few different ways to approach what you're asking, right? But I guess if we're talking about maintenance, like, it's just, it's difficult. Like, there's a lot of things that can, like, okay, so maybe think of it as like a German car versus a Japanese car.
Okay.
So like, if you own an Audi, you know, and something break, I've not owned one, but I was thinking about buying one recently, and I'm told that like when they go wrong in really weird ways. Like, you might have like a problem with your electrical harness where, like, you know, there's a bad solder joint that's like inside the, you know, rear driver's side door. And now some schmuck has to go in and find that. And, you know, hand solder it, and, you know, who knows how many technician hours they're going to log, and they got to be a really good tech to figure out where it's at and troubleshoot it.
Yeah.
And it's just laborious. Whereas with like a Japanese car, you know, a lot of times, like, they're just, the quality systems that they manufacture them with are just so refined that, you know, not to seem racist to the Germans and favorable to the Japanese, but, you know, it seems to be the case. I drive a Toyota myself. And so, you know, in my Toyota, if something breaks, chances are, like, Toyota knows, you know, they've documented where it's broken before, you know, and it's usually just replacing a component.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's much more predictable, the maintenance failures you have.
And that's, you know, the result of not only years and years of that engineering, but it's already at a scale, right? They're already producing at such scale that the investment into all those little nuanced capacities to fix it really efficiently are well worth it. It's like, Boston Dynamic can have a demo.
Well, it's what makes Toyota competitive as a company is the fact that they've got the greatest quality control system in the world.
Right. And so that system and the scale is wildly different than what is still effectively a demo of something that was, you know, much more akin to like the F1 cars that race.
Yeah.
And we see how often stuff goes wrong with them.
That's a good analogy.
Because they're pushing the bleeding edge, but like one little thing goes off and you're not competitive with the other 19 cars on the circuit.
Well, and if you did want to, you know, create evil robots, you know, that kill people, you know, just to go down that road, I mean, probably legs aren't your best way to do it, you know, like there's, you know, I mean, okay, so let's talk about the Boston Dynamics robots problems. And I don't want to get too hung up on killer robots, but I mean,
yeah,
it's a fun example. And I think we all know it's sci-fi. So basically, you know, if you have a robot with legs, like, first of all, like, even just to stand still, and you and I do this too, we just don't realize it because our brain's doing it so fast and we've got good systems for fuel and, you know, it ate a bagel or whatever. And so, you know, the robot's draining battery just to stand still, right? So if it's standing there, you know, with its evil robot laser death beam and just, you know, doing nothing but standing there, it's running down its battery already, right? And I mean, like, that's... So now there's a charging logistics problem just to keep it standing there.
So would a good metaphor be then, like, in context of battle, there's a reason, like, tanks are better than, like, a single soldier on multiple vectors? Is it, from that standpoint, would that be a fair assessment, or am I going way too...
I think that's a little bit of a different thing, right? Okay. I mean, tanks have a heavier level of armament. I mean, I study history. I've not worked on tanks.
But they just have the wheel, the chassis that just can kind of sit on the ground. At
correct. Yeah, yeah. Nobody's building mechs, right? Like, yeah. There's a reason nobody's building mechs, put it that way.
Got it.
So there's, like, you know, we all saw those Mech Warrior video games, or at least I played them growing up. It was a lot of fun. And you know, there's, like, tons of, you know, anime or whatever. I'm not, like, a huge anime fan, but I've seen it.
Yeah.
And so there's tons of anime with, like, you know, giant humanoid robot Power Rangers, right? That was, like, part of the premise, or Transformers.
Yeah.
You know, but, I mean... there's just so much more that can go wrong. Like, what actual technical utility do you get out of having legs that you don't get from tank tracks, right? And I'm a little biased because I have built, you know, quite a few robots with tank tracks on them.
Yeah.
But, you know, even then, I'll kind of eat my own words and say wheels might be better than tank tracks for a lot of stuff. And they're easier to maintain. If a tank track breaks, it's a big pain in the ass to change it. Like, you have to... I think with military tanks, just from, like, watching documentaries, again, haven't worked on them myself, but I mean, I believe you have to drive over the new track, and, you know, I mean, the track isn't light, like, it weighs probably thousands of pounds if I had to guess. And so just to thread that, you know, whereas a wheel, I mean, you jack the thing up, you pull the old wheel off and you put the new wheel on and you're done.
Yeah.
You know, so even if, you know, it's more likely to break if it goes over a rock, I mean, you know, just put 8 of them on there and then be able to run on, you know, 4 to 6, and you got some redundancy. I mean, 18 wheelers do that, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm a big fan of simplicity. Like, I think that, you know, if a mechanism's not providing actual real life value, like legs, for instance, you know, like, don't put them on there because they're just going to cost you money and add complexity. And it's money on the front end in terms of the non-recurring engineering expense, NRE. It's money in terms of production complexity, because now you've got to stock all these different actuator types, and, you know, you've got to make different, you know, joints, and you know, it's just a more mechanically complex thing. And it's money on the maintenance side, because there's a million things that can go wrong. And now you've got charging logistics issues, because it can't just power down and sit there. It's, well, you can, but you're slumped down. If you look at the Agility Robotics digit, I think that's how it powers down, as it just kind of becomes limp, like one of the Star Wars Phantom Menace droids.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I mean, for most cases, I think that I'm a little bit bearish on humanoid robots, if I'm being honest.
No, that's a informative and educational take, because I just see the demo and I'm like, feels like this isn't what we should be optimistic for. Seems scary. But I appreciate you talking us through that and helping us just to lay bare the way that you think through a problem like that is really educational. As we kind of aim towards the back nine of the conversation, Spencer, I'm curious if there are things that either you're waiting for or you're, you know, excited to see the technology sector go pursue in some sort of realistic time horizon, like the problems that you're like, I'm lit on fire by the opportunity to either be a part of solving them or to see someone has actually resolved them in some way,
sure.
shape, or form.
Yeah. So I will say one thing that's you know, of interest to me is space robots. So actually recently had a man named Eddie Tunstall on my podcast for the second time. And he's a genius. Like, I don't say that about very many people, but he is one of the smartest people I've ever talked to in my life. He's worked on pretty much every single Mars rover. And every time I talk to him, I want to work on space more and more. Like, I'm maybe a cynical guy. I feel like there's, you know, a lot of like rah, rah, rah around that.
And, yeah.
But I mean, there's also a lot of incredibly amazing stuff that's at the precipice of human achievement and technology that's being worked on there. I mean, I was an intern at SpaceX in 2013, and that's when they were first working on the vertical landing system, which was obviously a game changer because now you don't have to throw a rocket away every time you use it.
Yeah.
And so that was really cool for me to see. I mean, that's where I first learned what a star tracker was, which is a device for looking at the position of the stars, kind of like we do with a GPS constellation and figuring out. It's different, but I mean, you know, for sake of a basic analogy, I'll get into the technical if someone emails me, but, you know, it's different, but, you know, you basically do what's called localization, which is figuring out where you are from looking at, you know, where stars are at. And that's a common navigational tactic in space. I mean, some of the things you have to do on, you know, the moon and on Mars, just because of the temperatures, some of the things you have to do to be able to get around radiation when you're in those environments, like for a guy like me who kind of gets off on solving really, really, really tough problems, like it's kind of a playground. And I mean, obviously, I don't say that because I take it lightly, but I say that because there's a lot of interesting problems to solve.
Yeah. And it is the remaining frontier because we have more or less discovered all of, you know, the surface of the planet.
Yeah.
And now we have to look to the stars as a species to identify the next frontier. One of my favorite TV shows is Deadwood. And it's about, you know, discovering the Western frontier. And
yeah, it's a great show.
Settling it. And it's brutal. It's harsh. Like, it is not an easy time. But you also appreciate the cunning and the skill and the intelligence and the problem solving required to make it then. And I would say that, you know, moving horizontally across land is not as difficult as actually, you know, shooting rockets at transversing space.
Well, and I mean, I don't think I'd want to go to Mars anytime soon because imagine, like, I wouldn't want to have gone to the West, I think, in the days of Deadwood either, right? Like, I mean, imagine being in a town of, I can't even be in a town with a 60,000 population. I'll start to get stir crazy because it's like not enough people.
Yeah.
I'm very extroverted if you haven't noticed. And so,
yeah.
I need human interaction with new folks on a regular basis in order to thrive. And for me, I don't think I'd be a good candidate for like early stage space exploration. But from the engineering side, I'm fascinated by it because the mechanisms you have to build to support human life, the mechanisms you have to build to support, you know, robot functioning. I mean, it's okay. So one of the things Eddie told me about that he worked on is this, I'm probably going to get the name wrong, but I think he referred to it as the cold arm. And it's a robot arm that can function at negative 180 centigrade. And so, I mean, that's colder than, you know, pretty much any, like, things that start to go wrong, you know, when you get down to those temperatures, like it's.
Because fluids move differently, like other elements like that you would just take for granted in most other environments.
The lubrication, your bearings is probably going to lock up. I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried to run a car where, and I mean, again, this isn't a problem I've worked on personally, so I'm kind of talking about this as an observer, but I don't know if you've ever tried to run a car where you bought it from like the South, or you got like, have you ever bought a used car from like a place where there isn't snow?
I have not.
Okay. Well, I bought like a Acura TL a while ago from Florida, and the fluids it had in it were such that they weren't designed for the temperatures here in Pittsburgh. So when I tried to shift gears, you know, it was kind of, in the winter, like I would feel like, you know, like it was kind of fighting against me.
Yeah.
Because of the viscosity of the lubricants, like that were like, you know, in the transmit, like, you know, it gets down to like little things like that. And then it just gets harder and harder and harder, the more extreme. So I will talk about something that I did work on that might illustrate the point, but from a different domain perspective. So one of the things that I worked on at SKA kind of early on in the company's existence was an underwater data collection system. So basically, what it was a module for collecting data on temperature, salinity, which is saltiness, dissolved oxygen content, And I think those are the only things, depth and like an open body of water, like a lake. So these things were paired with what we called a winch system, which raised and lowered it into and out of the water. And then it had data logging electronics inside. And then what you would do is these were run from unmanned surface vehicles, so robot boats on the surface. They would raise and lower these sensor pods into and out of the water. They'd take measurements, and then you'd link it all together with a real-time clock to corroborate it to GPS data on the surface. You make a 3D map of like the saltiness of a lake at different depths, because it changes as you go up and down, and you start to see like interesting like underwater waves of like just temperature.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't look as much into the dissolved oxygen data personally. I was more concerned with building the device, but making something not leak is a really interesting problem. I talked to Rich Juknowitz from Four Moms about this in a recent podcast. When you're trying to make something, so there's something called an ingress protection level in engineering. And what it means is protection against ingress of dust and water. So like keeping stuff out of your robot, basically. And so it's a 2-digit code. And I think IP65 is like protection against, you know, falling droplets. IP66, I believe. I might be getting this wrong, but it's not important what the actual numbers are. So there's one level where it's protection against falling droplets, like basically just from above, like rain. There's another one where it's protection against soft water jets, like a garden hose, you know, maybe with a person's finger over it. There's another one that's like protection against strong water jets. So now you have like maybe pressure washer might even be stronger than that, but you know, can it stand up to a pressure washer being sprayed at it? And then you start to get into underwater, you know, levels of ingress protection, which I think starts around IP67 or IP68. And then you get up higher than that, and it gets kind of weird, the rating system, because you can't really account for all the different depths. But even making something work under a meter of water is a really, really difficult problem. I've actually thought about writing some articles on this. I want it because a lot of this stuff's lab tested right now, and people will spend tens of thousands of dollars just booking lab time to get something validated. But a lot of the time, you know, you need to test it before that, because there's all kind of, you have a little bit of dust in your O-ring groove, that's going to cause ingress protection. You've got a slight machining, you know, irregularity, that's going to cause ingress as well. So I shouldn't have said protection, but it's going to cause ingress.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that can cause something to leak. And the deeper down you get, the higher the pressure gets, the more difficult a problem you're solving. Because now, you know, maybe you get so deep, then you've got, you know, this, say you've got like a cube with like a hatch on the side. Well, what happens when the walls of your cube are getting pushed in by the pressure of the water? Maybe the shape was right to keep the water out, but now that it's getting deformed, you know, all of a sudden it isn't, and water just starts flooding in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was a really, really difficult problem to work on, and still is. I mean, I think any engineer that's tried to make something waterproof, and I mean, I've seen this, like, you know, with mature companies, with products that they make, you know, in the tens of thousands of units, where they still have issues with ingress. You know, it's incredibly difficult.
Wow.
I mean, remember how many generations of iPhone couldn't handle, yeah, like, you know, a little splash?
Yeah.
And there's a reason why.
And that pales in comparison to the problems he's solving at whatever, how correct, many, yeah, negative,
sorry,
degrees centigrade.
Kind of went off on a tangent there.
No,
yeah.
That was great. I loved it. It's just to appreciate what the long tail is of those engineering problems.
And it gets harder and harder and harder and harder and harder the longer you get down that tail.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. Glad that's someone else's job. Oh, man. Spencer, you have bended my mind here. I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show and walking us through everything. I want to make sure that people can check out the episodes that you referenced, learn more about SKA, and all the interesting things that you have going on. What digital coordinates can we provide people if they want to learn more?
Sure. So I will say, check out my LinkedIn. It's just LinkedIn/in/Spencer Krause. SKA's website's currently being redone. So hopefully by the time people see this, it's a shiny new one, but that's SKA.solutions. That's Sierra Kilo Alpha dot the word solutions with an S at the end, plural. If we could flash that below, that would be sweet.
Right on.
My podcast, Collaborative with Spencer Krause, is available on pretty much every podcast platform and also YouTube. It's a lot of fun to make. You can check out Aaron's episode, which is a really fun one to record.
Go check out Eddie's or literally any of the other episodes. Mine was by far the worst, I promise.
It was really good. I actually got a lot of positive feedback.
Nice. Well, I'm glad people enjoyed it, but there's a lot of good interviews on there. And if this dive into just some of the technical nuances of your work was appetizing, then Collaborative just takes it to the next level with the, you know, two domain expertise, experts talking to one another, not one domain expert. And
I mean, you're an expert as well, just on a different domain.
Yeah, exactly. But I strongly recommend it. Hope people check that out. And we will link that all in the show notes, goingdeepwithaaron.com/podcast, or in the app where you're probably listening to this right now. Before we let Spencer go, we're going to give him the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge to the audience.
Sure. So for this actionable personal challenge, this is something I've actually been doing myself quite a lot lately, which is, you know, maybe tomorrow take just half an hour to an hour out of your day, which I know feels like a lot, but you know, try 15 minutes, whatever gets you going, and think about ways that you can make your own job more efficient. I've been talking to certain colleagues a lot about this, and I don't have the numbers to back this up yet, but our general feeling seems to be, and I'm sure somebody does have the numbers for this, that you see ROI if you do this for an hour every day in about a year, where you start getting that time back and then more and more and more. I know I try to make my job more efficient. I could be better at it. And if people do this and they want to reach out and tell me what they did, I'd feel really good about it. So yeah, take a little bit of time out of your next day and try to figure out ways to make your own job more efficient.
We just did a training with Piper and used the overused line, I believe from the Navy SEALs, of slow is smooth and smooth is fast, where it's like it's slow at first to be considering the actual how of your work versus just like doggedly pursuing it. But when you're really prepared, you're really well organized, you're making yourself, you know, a smooth operator in every sense, net, you go really fast. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's different ways to approach the problem, but I love that challenge and I'm going to take it. I hope that you take it. I hope that you appreciate this conversation. Spencer, thank you so much for coming on, man.
It's been a pleasure, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
We just went deep with Spencer Krause. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Hey, thanks for listening to the end of my interview with Spencer. If you enjoyed it, you'd also enjoy listening to another interview with a roboticist, Jürgen Pedersen. He recently sold his company, RE Squared Robotics, but we interviewed him years ago while he was still building the company, how he took it from being bootstrapped to venture-backed, and how they get large Department of Defense contracts. Go check it out.